Should we invade Haiti? How about tax-free vouchers for private schools? Should DNA tests be admitted in criminal trials? Just hit the yes or no buttons on your TV remote control and you can make public policy. Is this the new electronic citizenship? Computer access to government. I'm Jude Tillman and this is the Communications Revolution. The White House is online, so are some senators and representatives. State legislative and city council minutes are online as well, at least a few of them. Computer access to speeches, agendas, and people is in its infancy, but already tens of thousands of email messages are flowing. Are we on the verge of a new era of electronic citizenship? Will it change the whole political equation with social action and not money becoming the major influence on our government? Our panel today is well-equipped to discuss the ups and downs of high-tech tools for citizen involvement. From Monitor Radio in Washington, D.C., we have Sonia Jarvis, who is the Executive Director of the National Coalition on Black Voter Participation, working to increase access to the political system for African Americans and other people of color communities. Also at Monitor Radio is Chris Casey, who is the Technology Policy Advisor to Senator Kennedy. He created a computer system for constituents to email the senator, one of only about 10 members of the Senate offering this form of access. And in our studios at KPFA in Berkeley, we're joined by Jim Warren, who is a longtime writer and organizer on issues related to government access. He was influential in passing the legislation that makes California the first state to offer its records free of charge over the Internet. We'll talk about access to government through cyberspace after this report from producer Claire Schoen.
It is obvious that this mode of instantaneous communication must inevitably become an instrument of immense power.
A century and a half ago, a new technology, the telegraph, changed forever the way people communicated. Grand predictions of its potential to influence our political institutions were made by many, including its inventor, Samuel Morse.
I trust that one of its effects will be to bind man to his fellow men in such bonds of amity as to put an end to war.
Today's breakthroughs in telecommunications also provoke grand predictions, such as claims that ordinary citizens using databases and electronic mail can affect political change and revitalize an apathetic populace. David Wiesner, a self-employed computer consultant, is one individual who's hopped onto the net in a one-man campaign for government reform.
I first heard about the lobbyist gift ban from a news program in which they showed senators and lobbyists skiing down the slopes in the Rocky Mountains for some supposed charity event.
Many of the senators are here with their families for some light competition and some heavy private partying with corporate big shots and lobbyists who pick up the tab. American Express, U.S. West, Delta Airlines.
Then they would get together in the evening for chat and drinks over by the fire and talk about legislation.
As just a taxpayer, you'd be lucky to get even a moment with your senator. But when special interests lure him off on one of these $7,000 vacations, they get his ear for 3 days and nights.
Senator Lautenberg proposed a bill to ban this activity, to ban gifts by lobbyists to members of Congress.
Senator Lautenberg has proposed a law against it. And what are his fellow senators saying about that?
I can't use that language on the air.
And boy, was I mad, and I really wanted to take some action. So the next day, I called up Senator Lautenberg's office. I found out that his bill was stuck in the Senate Government Operations Committee. They weren't going to do anything about banning lobbyist gifts. And I said, this cannot stand.
David Wiesner was determined to get the gift ban bill passed. He got in touch with Gary Ruskin, director of Ralph Nader's Congressional Accountability Project, which fights for legislative reform.
I gave David a wide variety of information, most of it having to do with bills, calendars. It's critical to know, for example, when a bill is going to be on the floor, and he needed interpretation of other law and strategic and tactical advice.
It became apparent that I had a great deal of access to information, but I had no way of distributing that information, so I tried to understand what my tools were that were available for me to do something about this. And one of the first things I noticed was that I had this great internet mail reflector available to me.
David had discovered an avenue on the internet through Bill Selmayr, an electronics marketing executive who is personally interested to see how the net can be used to organize. Involved in Perot's United We Stand America, Selmayr had created something called a network reflector.
It's simply a mail list. It's simply a list that has a whole bunch of electronic mail addresses on it. We send it to uwsa@shell.portal.com. It will get distributed to over 100 people who are on this list right now. And in fact, our reflector includes people from Puget Sound to San Diego to New Hampshire to Miami. And you can marshal a large number of people very quickly this way.
So I started a newsletter, which I called Ban Bribery Now, because I wanted to get people a little bit riled up. What I was doing was I was getting the scuttlebutt that I was getting from the people in Washington, and I was writing it in this newsletter. And then I would go and I would tell people in a section called Action Now exactly what they could do and where they could do it to be most effective.
He took this thing, he put it up on the reflector, and people all over the country could pick up these messages that Dave would publish and then republish them with his blessing. So on email, it went into America Online, it went into Prodigy, it went into CompuServe, it went into Genie, it went into Delphi.
Most importantly, it started generating thousands and thousands of letters to Congress saying, ban bribery now. And it really scared the daylights out of them because they had no idea where this was coming from. They didn't even know that anybody knew about this bill.
Clerk will read the bill for a third time.
Calendar number 419, S-1935, a bill to prohibit lobbyists and their clients from providing to legislative branch officials certain gifts.
Yeas and nays have been ordered. Clerk will call the roll.
Mr. Akaka. Mr. Baucus.
Congress simply jumped,
Mr.
and they ran over each other in a kind of a game of chicken trying to toughen up the bill when it finally got to a floor vote.
Tell them what the outcome was, because it was an amazing vote.
The final vote was 95 in favor, 4 against.
On this measure, the yeas are 95, the nays are 4, the bill is passed.
For David, the Internet proved to be a cheap and easy tool to educate and organize. However, gaining access to computer databases to research congressional legislation, information he needed to wage his campaign, that was a different matter. He was lucky to have his contact in Washington, Gary Ruskin.
Getting any of this material was difficult. You have to get it from a series of magazines like Roll Call or National Journal or Congressional Quarterly, which are not in everybody's library. Sometimes legislation is hard to get a hold of, and so you have to beg and plead with staffers to get you a copy.
Right now, any congressperson can dial in to the legislative computer and get full information about these bills. So the technology is already in place. The only thing that they haven't provided is a link for the citizens.
I got almost none of it or none of it online, which is terrible because, if you live out in Kansas and you're trying to do this kind of work, you're basically out of luck.
I think the reason is simple. Access is power. If you can restrict access to information, then you retain power to the people who have that information.
However, in California, citizens have now gained free online access to information about their state government, thanks in large part to computer activist Jim Warren.
Assembly Bill 1624 is a mandate that essentially all already computerized public legislative information be made available to all of the public via the Internet. And that same thing is happening in other states. There are bills in Washington, Oklahoma, Texas, New Jersey, New York.
We become a community through communication. Human beings interact. And we no longer have interactive communication that we had when we had a town hall, when we had a public square, when we could all fit in to our city council meeting.
Karen Coyle works with computer professionals for social responsibility. She feels that telecommunications can help us rebuild this lost sense of community.
People talk about community on the internet, and it's all happening really electronically over these wires, and it's astonishing to watch news pass across the internet. Something can happen somewhere in the world, and within minutes, that information has covered the entire globe.
It is not visionary to suppose that it would not be long ere the whole surface of this country would be channeled to diffuse with the speed of thought a knowledge of all that is occurring, making, in fact, one neighborhood of the whole country.
Mr. Bingaman.
I'm Claire Schoen for the Communications Revolution.
Mrs. Boxer.
David Wiesner's fight for a gift ban bill is not over. As of our broadcast, the bill sits in conference committee. Its sponsors promise it will make it to the floor for a vote. Activists like Gary Ruskin believe it could die a quiet death. Some people will always wax enthusiastic about the potential of technology to create a better world. We just heard Samuel Morris say that the telegraph would turn the world into one big neighborhood and put an end to war. Let's turn to our panelists with this one. Sonia Jarvis, you're devoted to increasing participation by citizens of color in the voting process. Now, that's certainly one important aspect of democracy. But would you agree that with email, fax, computer voting, we're on the cusp of a golden age of democracy?
Well, certainly, Jude, if we find that the safeguards that we've built into our system over 200 years are also applied to this new technology. I'm certainly very excited about the prospects of making democracy work for average Americans. But to go back to a point that was raised in your intro, when we're making comparisons between the old town hall meetings and the town hall square, a lot of the people I represent were left out of those meetings in the past. And I just want to make sure that we don't see history repeat itself with these new technologies.
And with these new technologies, people are beginning to acknowledge we are creating a world of haves and have-nots, Jim Warren, a world in which some people have access and the most of us don't, a growing technological elite, if you will. Now, how can we ensure that this technological elite doesn't have unfair access to the ear of our public officials?
It's my contention that essentially the foremost barricade to access is the ability to read and write. The second biggest barricade is the ability to type. All the rest of the barriers to access are trivial in comparison to those barricades. The cost of access to the internet or to online communications is in the order of $15 to $30 a month in most metropolitan areas in the United States right now, and it's expanding radically by the month.
So you don't think that there are that many barriers? Let me throw it back at you, Sonia Jarvis. If you had to choose, what would you say is the single greatest obstacle to the kind of two-way electronic information we're aiming for?
Well, I'd take issue with Mr. Warren just in this sense, that when we're hearing from our education department that nearly half of the adults in this country have trouble dealing with complex information, then I'm not feeling comfortable that simply having an ability to read and write is going to be enough to enable people to use these networks well. That an important aspect of this whole notion of universal access that I'm sure we'll get to is also the question of training. If you have a computer, and many schools around the country have computers now, but no one's using them because they never received the training to use them. So I think it's a bit more than just a question of can you read or can you write. I think it goes also to questions such as culture, such as an encouragement of math and sciences and other capabilities that make it easier to use these new technologies. And that's what I'm focusing on. When I look at the voting process, for example, we know that a number of people can read and write, but that does not automatically translate into a vote at the polling place, and having been involved in that difficult process of bridging the gap, I'm just concerned that we not overlook that as we, as a society, move toward these new forms of technology for doing the public's business.
People have to have the political will as well, as what you're saying. Chris Casey, let's bring you into the discussion. Chris, you set up an email system for your boss, Senator Ed Kennedy. Are you finding that you're getting interaction with people out there in among the citizenry that you didn't hear from before through email, or can you tell?
I think without question, certainly the ease with which someone can send an email message is quite quicker to send off a thought or concern to your representative than perhaps the amount of time it might take you to write a letter. And I think we are hearing from a lot of individuals who might just in a moment send off a thought, ask a question that they might otherwise not have gone to the trouble to.
But you're receiving right now about 20 to 30 email messages per day, as opposed to you still receive about 4,000 letters per week. So it's clearly not out of hand yet.
Absolutely, and I believe it'll be quite some time. But what's important to note, I think, is that while we've opened up this electronic avenue for reaching Senator Kennedy, we haven't closed any of the more traditional means. And in an attempt to make sure that we don't create an electronic elite among constituents reaching us this way, we ask people who send email to Senator Kennedy to include a postal address. They'll get an autoresponder that acknowledges the receipt of that message, but what the congressional office then ends up with is the message with a return address, and they'll get a reply with a letter.
Does that work? Absolutely.
People are very happy with that, and what it does as a first step towards increasing acceptance of email as a way of reaching a congressional office is it ensures for us that email is treated no better or no worse than any communication or question that came with a stamp on it.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's back up. I'm intrigued by the notion of how we can use these technologies to perhaps heighten the political willpower that Sonia Jarvis was referring to a little earlier. Let's get back to, say, voting, which is certainly an easier act than writing an email message. In terms of trying to influence our government, there were a number of kiosks with touch screens used in South Africa this past in spring of 94 to educate people who were not necessarily literate and who were voting for the first time in their lives, using graphics and other means to show what an election means, why voting is important, where and how to vote, that sort of thing. Could technology, perhaps, Sonia Jarvis, encourage more political will, if you will, more interest, less apathy on the part of the electorate?
I certainly think so, and I applaud the efforts of a number of cities around the country, especially a number in California, a number in Massachusetts, and also in the Washington area, that are trying to put the daily workings of government online and in an available form. Kiosks, as you mentioned, is one way to do that, because then you're not relying on people to be that adept at using computers. They can touch a screen or they see a picture that they relate to, and that can lead them through the system. And I'm certainly in favor of any type of technology that helps us to do that. I think your broader question, of course, is will these technologies be a way for those of us who are trying to reach out and encourage greater voting across the board, will these technologies be a way to do that? And I certainly think they can be. I just want to make sure that we're also taking into account the ways that it can be used in a harmful fashion. During the Persian Gulf War, for example, a number of servicemen and women were able to vote back at home by using voting by fax, which I think is a wonderful idea. But on the other hand, once that fax is received, we want to make sure that it's also protected the way a normal ballot would be protected. That's, I think, a good example of what I'm talking about. The fax capability allowed those service personnel serving our country in the Gulf to cast their vote in a positive, productive fashion. But at the same time, on the state level, we have to be concerned with how those ballots are going to be protected.
Privacy and secrecy issues, very good,
certainly.
Good issues for the technology to take into consideration, I think, through some sort of protection of identification, Jim Warren? Or?
Well, privacy is a major issue through this whole thing. But to the issue of access for a second, this is a temporary problem. It's like horseless carriages before electric starters were on them. Not very many people used horseless carriages until electric starters were on them. Then a whole a much expanded scope of people were willing to use them because they were easy. We're in exactly the same thing with computing access or with computer-based access to public information and to elected officials and, most importantly, to the body politic itself, us communicating with ourselves as a political entity. And the technology is very rapidly improving to a point-and-click technology, to icons or graphic pictures that make it much, much easier to
touch
use.
Touchscreen.
Yeah. For instance, Women's Wire, which has something like 70 or 80% of its participants are women. It uses a very friendly, human-friendly, as opposed to nerd-friendly, interface that makes it palatable for people who don't like computers, don't want to learn computers, and so on, nonetheless to be able to use them. And that's happening very rapidly all across the net and all across the electronic communication system.
Just speaking with Jim Warren, he's a writer, a teacher, an organizer for on issues related to government access. You're listening to the Communications Revolution. You can contact us via email at kpfa@well.com. That's kpfa@well.com. And if you're one of the fortunate few who are techno-literate and you're on the Internet, you're an Internet user, you can join our Internet chat after the show to continue the discussion by heading for the site TRP9. That's TRP9 on the Internet. Chris Casey, this thing about touch screens and access to government info, that making it more accessible to people who aren't necessarily propeller heads, if you excuse the phrase, do you see any sign among elected officials in Senator Kennedy's office, for example, that there are any technology initiatives that would make what Kennedy's doing on a day-to-day business, on a day-to-day basis, more available to his constituents in that way?
I think so, and I think what our office has done has been a good example. We've had certainly a lot of other congressional offices contact us who have said, we've heard from people who have found Senator Kennedy on the net, and tell us what you're doing, because they're asking us how. We've certainly benefited from assistance from the Artificial Intelligence Lab at MIT, which is good help to have. But what's exciting is as Jim pointed out, it is becoming easy enough to be point-and-click using an application called Mosaic to explore what's called the World Wide Web. Citizens in Cambridge, Massachusetts, can now drop into the public library, sit down in front of a computer that has city directories, local information, and so on about the city of Cambridge available, and then one click away, they could be visiting Senator Kennedy's office. From our office, they're a click away to exploring all other kinds of Massachusetts resources as well as other federal government servers. And so the ease of use truly is reaching a point where people can learn about an issue and then explore that issue from all levels, whether it's at the local city level, state, or right on up to the federal government.
Sonia Jarvis, just one click away, just point and click. Are these the kinds of answers to your problem of trying to get people involved in government?
I think it's one half of the answer, and I'm very excited about the type of user-friendly, in the positive sense, interfaces that both Jim and Chris have mentioned. And I should point out that even looking at Mosaic, which a number of offices are now trying to adopt, was developed at a university in Illinois. And that's the type of thing that I think I certainly want to see encouraged. But if we allow this entire effort to be driven by commercial interests, we're not going to see necessarily, I don't think, that type of outreach to make sure that these technologies are widely available.
Well, I'm glad you brought up commercial interest, which is the other side of the equation. It's not just citizen input to government, but getting information about what government's doing. Right now, government uses a lot of commercial information servers. Is that not true, Jim Warren? There was, a project where Taxpayer Assets Project, which is a consumer protection group, tried to get some basic legal records, judicial records, and were unable to obtain them through the Freedom of Information Act because the Department of Justice said, I'm sorry, we contract them out to West Publishing Company, which in turn turns around and sells them to citizens. So, in effect, we're getting billed twice. Once our taxes are paying for the Department of Justice to contract this information out, and then we have to go buy the information. Is this common for the government to sell government information?
It's both common for government to sell information and also for it to buy it. I have no objection at all to private sector companies computerizing government information and selling it for whatever they can get from it. I have a great objection, however, to a government agency granting a monopoly control over public records that have been paid for by tax funds and granting a monopoly control over electronic access to that information to a single for-profit information purveyor. And that's very common, although a lot of us are fighting to change that. And in fact, the bill last year to make state legislative information in California available for free turned that problem around.
But there's a problem with that bill now, isn't there?
Not with that bill. That one's already implemented, and it made California the first state in the nation to provide free online access to legislative information from anywhere in the world via the public networks, namely the Internet and everything connected to it, which is almost everything. What's in trouble right now here in California is that at the there is a that, all right, that was the legislative information. We've got that done. Now we've been going after the executive branch information, and everything was fine up until about 2 days ago or a week ago when they amended in language that said, oh, if you're already selling it for profit, you government agencies, you can't or you're exempt from making it available for free.
So any existing contracts get to stick. We're discussing access and participation in democracy through new interactive computer technologies, costs to citizens, whether there should be costs, and how citizens can offer their electronic input to government. You've been hearing from Sonia Jarvis, who's the executive director of the National Coalition on Black Voter Participation. Jim Warren is a writer and advocate of government information availability online. And Chris Casey is the technology policy advisor to Senator Edward Kennedy. I'm Jude Tillman, and this is the Communications Revolution. We'd like to hear from you right now. Give us your thoughts on participatory government via computerized networks. You can join our discussion with your questions and comments by calling 1-800-848-2298. That's 1-800-848-2298. We'll be right back.
The Communications Revolution is produced at KPFA, Pacifica Radio in Berkeley, with funds from the Telecommunications Education Trust, established by the California Public Utilities Commission. It's distributed by Pacifica National Programming. Barry Scott is the executive producer. The associate producer is Carol Klinger. The managing editor is John Rieger. The associate editor is Claire Schoen. For a cassette tape or a written transcript of this program, call the Pacifica Radio Archive at 1-800-735-0230 and ask for the Communications Revolution, Program 994. This is the Communications Revolution.
A lot lot of information concerning Congress is available online, but ordinary citizens can't access it because it's too expensive. The Congressional Record now costs $375 a year online. The Federal Register is another $375 a year online. And so most citizens are redlined out of that market.
Are most people redlined out of the market of government information? And why should it cost anything to access the Congressional Record by computer? We're talking about access to your government and whether computers and modems are going to make it any easier to find out what the government's doing. You can offer your comment on today's topic by calling us at 1-800-848-2298. But why does the information cost so much, Jim Warren, and what can we do about that?
Sometimes it costs a lot because a for-profit entity is making profit off of it. Often, however, it costs a lot because the public agency itself is using public information, often acquired, if you will, at the point of a gun, to make profit, selling that information in its useful form, that is, in its electronic form, at high profit to people who can afford to pay for it. It creates an inequity of access that is, in my estimation or opinion, inappropriate in a free society.
Mm-hmm. What do you mean by obtained at the point of a gun?
When they say, you will give us your name and address and height and age and weight and put it into a Department of Motor Vehicles driver's license record, then turn around and sell it for millions of dollars a year, that's at the point of a gun.
Absolutely. Let's bring our listeners in from San Francisco. We're joined by Martin. Welcome to the program, Martin.
Thank you. We were wondering about this issue as it might apply to a specific in a locality. Let's take San Francisco, where one of the areas of interest at the moment and discussion for public policy is the setting up of an agenda for charter reform. Now, if we wanted to include people who might not have access to a PC at home or elsewhere or might prefer it in the public arena, is it doable at this point, and how difficult is it to set up a network with the public libraries or other local facilities that would have where people of all economic means would have access?
Thank you for your call, Martin. Jim Warren.
There are a variety of access alternatives for the public or for members of the public if they don't have a computer and a modem at their own home. One is through the public libraries, and that is rapidly falling out to be a sort of default standard access channel for public to get information, just as it has been for over a century. Other alternatives are to go through schools, through nonprofit organizations. In San Francisco, there's even a network system that has computer terminals in cafes that are coin-operated. It's a private sector operation, but it's very inexpensive. And among other things, the homeless, many of the homeless in San Francisco, are using that. They'll borrow a quarter, drop it in there, and then know enough to log on and pick up their electronic mail because they are moving around constantly, find out where homeless shelters are still open instead of having to trundle all over the city from place to place to find out that they got there too late, find out where meals are available, where various kinds of health and child care services are available, and so on.
These may exist in theory, but are they really used by homeless
Yes.
folks to find out? How is that measured? How is that gauged? Can you tell who's using it and why they're using it?
I would suspect that you can tell that it's being used. I mean, the system the system operators have an idea of how much their system is used.
And what information is requested off of it?
Probably not. I mean, that raises a privacy issue.
Mm-hmm.
Of the system operator should not be monitoring who's using the system to access what particular item, much less read their email and see what they're talking about.
Let's bring in Susan from Oakland. Hello, Susan. You're on the air.
Hi. I would like to see politically progressive organizations and media do a better job of letting people know how they can communicate with their governments at all levels, because I don't know if my assumptions about who has computers are naive, but it seems to me that we might be able to get the jump on the fundies who are quite well organized when it comes to old-fashioned communication. They've got their phone trees, and they deluge the legislators with letters. But it seems I'd like to think that progressive people are more perhaps greater represented in a greater degree among people who do have computers. And if we could just get organized, we might be able to do a little better job of lobbying on issues. I had an occurrence to think about this last week. We had in the community where I live in Fremont, the local school board canceled a play that was being shown to high school students all over the state about AIDS, because there's a very vocal fundy community, and they're very loud. And I would have loved to have been able to get on my computer and send a message to the school board telling them what I think of them for their cowardice, but I don't know how to do that. I don't know how to get in touch with my local government.
Listen. Susan, let me ask you, what is a fundy community?
Religious right.
The religious right.
Yeah, they organize and mobilize to... Fremont is the only community that has refused to show this play to high school students about AIDS.
Mm-hmm. All right, thank you very much, Susan, for your call, referring to fundamentalists, Christian fundamentalists. Go ahead, Jim Warren, you're chafing at the bit here.
Well, one of the first problems you'd run into is probably the school board members are not online. However, it's not only progressive groups that are using the net, but libertarian groups. Libertarians have a major presence on the net. The Ross Perot, although Ross Perot's headquarters was not online during his campaign, the Ross Perot grassroots activists certainly are. But in the progressive area, things like EcoNet, ConflictNet for conflict resolution workers, PeaceNet are all longtime, very powerful progressive communication systems.
Chris Casey, could you let our listener know what some email addresses might be that she could contact?
Absolutely. You can start with ours, Susan. senator@kennedy.senate.gov will reach our office. And from that, you'll be getting a responder that will help point you to other government resources. An email message to congress@hr.house.gov will give you a reply that has a list of members of the House of Representatives that are using email. I think Jim pointed out earlier that on Capitol Hill, as in a lot of places, we're at an early stage as far as the implementation, and I think without a doubt, ultimately, it will be as routine for a member of Congress to have an email address and to make information about their activities available electronically as it is for a congressional office to have a telephone. And yet, at this stage of the game, there's still only the early few who are doing it. All members of Congress have access to Internet email and all have the ability to make information available online. And it's really up to the public and individual citizens like Susan who are interested in that kind of access to demand it.
Okay, again, that email address for to find out who in Congress is online is congress@hr.house.gov.
For the House side.
For the House side. Let's bring another caller into the program, Patrick from Long Beach. Hello, Patrick.
Hello, it's a good program. I have a question. I'm a cable TV public access producer in Long Beach, and I'm very much a supporter of the right of the public to public access, whether it's cable casting or broadcasting, and I'm becoming more computer literate myself, but as a political activist, I don't have access to information that would help me and other people in my community make informed choices politically, and I usually read about bills in the legislature after they've been passed, unfortunately, and it sort of precludes us in the general public from making informed choices. I mean, I do support the right of public online services, but my question is, how would they be funded without so people who could use them without necessarily owning buying expensive computer and modems?
That's a very good question. Thank you for your call, Patrick. How are we going to make this information accessible electronically to all the people out here who don't have computers and modems?
Well,
Sonia, are you trying to get
in? Sure. I'd just like to respond to both Patrick and Susan's concerns on that. For starters, in addition to the addresses that Chris gave, this week in the Washington Post, on the federal page, the Post is running a series showing the actual Internet addresses for senators, for members of Congress, for government documents that are available online, the addresses of various agencies that are already in place with electronic communication systems. But beyond that, I think Patrick's point is getting to what I think you started the program with, and that is the whole notion of a public right of access. That, at this point, that concept is one that's being discussed. In fact, Senator Inouye has introduced a bill, Senate Bill 2195, that talks about actually reserving some of this communication spectrum for use by local government, nonprofit groups, and other groups working in the public interest. And I think it's important that we not lose sight of the need for that, because otherwise, without that type of protection, we'll see that that this entire spectrum is taken up by commercial interests. And I certainly don't have any problem with that. I just think it's important that we do protect a portion of this new emerging area for use of the public. And one of the ways we do that is by allowing nonprofit groups, whether we're talking about the Computer Professionals for Social Responsibility or other groups that you mentioned in the introduction, that are poised to give Patrick the kind of information he's asking for. How do I find out about legislation? It's nice to know that it's available, but if I can't get to it, I can't use it. And that's what we're trying to do, we meaning a number of nonprofit groups around the country. We're arguing for the need of nonprofit rates in much the same way we have nonprofit rates in the postal system.
One group that we are in contact with, Taxpayers Assets Project, suggested, and to further answer Patrick's question, the government currently spends about $50 million per year on just two contracts with Lexis and Westlaw to sell government information online, and that perhaps they could better use that money to make it available in libraries and other public locations for people who don't have computers. I do feel the need also to tag on one thing about the Telecommunications Act of 1994, Sonia Jarvis, that you were referring to. Senator Inouye's section of that, SB 2195, did originally specify 20% of the access of the new information superhighway to be for public interest. It's been whittled down through compromises to about 5%, so it's something we all need to keep an eye on. Let's take another caller, Paul in Taos, New Mexico. Welcome to the program, Paul.
Thank you. I think one of the things we need to address here is we're talking about the issue of access, and we have access coming from two directions here. We're addressing this where the nonprofits are giving people access to computers or to the network in order to get access to this government information, and we need the government information to be available. What I want people to think about is the community networking movement that's happening in the country now. We're based in Taos, New Mexico. We are setting up a telecommunity center where individuals from the community can come in, sit down, get educated on how to use these networking tools, and have access for free to the network for 15 hours a month.
That's good information. Thank you, Paul. Jim?
These types of systems, which are local civic systems, are generally referred to as civic networks or community networks. They are exploding into existence across the nation. In large cities and towns, such as San Francisco, in small communities such as Taos, medium-sized communities such as Cupertino, California, and some of them are operated by a government agency, by a local government agency. Others are operated by a private nonprofit organization, often using a system called FreeNet, and may charge, for instance, Silicon Valley Public Access Link, charges $20 a year for access.
Fairly,
not a month, a year.
Fairly inexpensive. Our number here again is 1-800-848-2298. If you want to join our discussion about getting and giving information and opinions to and from government electronically, 1-800-848-2298. I have a question, Chris Casey, and to anyone who would like to respond. What about government secrecy? It seems that we certainly saw in the report at the beginning of the hour, government would like to not be held accountable in terms of interest groups buying their ear for a couple days at Vail ski resorts or what have you. But also, couldn't Ali North or Nixon and Watergate or somebody hide their the evidence of their misdeeds better by putting it in some electronic file in Switzerland someplace? Or, you know, when we no longer have a paper trail, how are we going to do good muckraking journalism?
Actually, to the contrary, I think Oliver North got in trouble specifically because he left an email record of his ongoings and forgot about backup tapes. But I do think that any technology that offers individual citizens more direct access to the kind of timely information that perhaps only lobbyist groups until now have been able to afford to get access to certainly should and can help make government more accountable exactly because they get the access in a timely manner that's useful to them. For example, Senator Kennedy is one of the original sponsors of the Technology for Education Act. A bill that would help promote networking and network access in K through 12 elementary schools. Earlier this spring, after the bill came out of subcommittee and was heading to the full labor committee for markup, we made the text of the bill available to the internet, let Massachusetts constituents and as well actually the whole internet world made them aware that it was online and encouraged them to email their comments. And so rather than learning after the fact about a bill that had passed or hadn't passed, they had the information in a timely manner, which allowed them to actually have a real impact. What needs to happen, of course, is rather than just a scattered bill here or there being available for all legislation that's under consideration to be available like this.
Online, right. All right, we bring another listener in at 1-800-848-2298 from Oakland. Let's hear from Danielle. Welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you. I'd like to address two areas. The political will that was mentioned earlier that is connected to the access issue and also security involved in using modems. I think that having telecommunity centers, as Paul was talking about, all over the state and country is excellent, but teaching people how to use the technology is not enough. And in terms of political will, I think that if people don't understand the legislative process itself, minus any technology, then people will not be able to use the technology effectively. So I think that has to start in the schools. And right now, school curriculums, I think, don't do a good job of teaching people how to become activists, and I think that there's a policy reason behind that, except that perhaps for individual teachers who make it their own agenda to make sure that people are very well educated. So I think we have to start at the school, the educational level, before we even get into technology. And in terms of the modems, I think it was Covert Action magazine reported a while back on a program that it was hijacked from the commercial company that developed it. It was used for monitoring judicial files, and it was spread basically around the world, and it's been used in diplomatic offices to basically pick up modem transmissions in diplomatic offices for various countries. So what is to prevent a government agenda such as COINTELPRO that happened 10 or 15 years ago from connecting onto people's modems and putting a lid on all of this activism that we're developing?
Thank you very much for your call, Danielle. You might want to tune in to our next show when we will be dealing with exactly that last subject that you bring up, government intrusion into citizen and business electronic communications. which doesn't mean we can't talk about it in this show as well. But Sonia Jarvis, first to you, because she's talking about education on computer technology very early in the classroom. Is that going to be sufficient to produce this informed and involved electorate?
Well, I think Danielle's question is right on point. I think we're almost expecting too much from our schools these days. We expect them almost to be social agencies and deal with every important issue in our communities, and yet some of the basic functions of school, that is educating the citizens of the future, is sometimes lost. And I think that we've seen over the last couple of decades a de-emphasis on basic civics education, so much so that a lot of people don't know the basics of how local government operates, much less how our federal government operates. And mm-hmm. I certainly would welcome a re-emphasis on basic educational information on how our system works, regardless of how you get in touch with the government, whether it's through the telephone or mm-hmm. through a modem. And in terms of her larger question, which you're going to address in your next show, I think it strikes at the heart of what is one of my major concerns. How can we make sure that very important rights and civil liberties that have been earned and fought for over two centuries are not lost in an instant because we have become fascinated with this new technology? And the only way it's going to be different to make sure that those safeguards are there is if ordinary citizens like the ones who have been calling in today make their opinions known and communicate their concerns to others within their community, however that community is defined.
Jim Warren, you're anxious to get in on this. Go ahead, Jim.
Three or four points. One is we're finding that there's a new generation of kids coming up who are using the networks in schools to communicate with each other, and it's a generation of kids who can actually read and write, that is, express themselves in written form. That's a change from the television generation. Secondly, many of the best teachers about using the computer nets in elementary and high schools are the kids, not the teachers, because they can pick it up faster. They don't know how complicated it is, and they just learn it. Knowledge of the legislative process. Last year when I helped push through this legislation in California, through a series of action alerts, just like Chris has done, or just like David Wiesner did with the Ban Bribery Now bill, I got a number of comments back from the people who were reading my action alerts saying, I've learned how the legislative process works just by seeing what all's going on. And if you think about it, the best way to learn anything, language, anything else, is to use it. Not study it in school, not study it in the abstract or in an academic form, but go out and use it. That's how David Wiesner learned it. That's how I learned it. That's how every effective political activist learns it.
We want to bring another caller on, but let me ask you real quick, Chris Casey, what about digital signatures on this email? How do you know who's sending you email is who they say they are, and how can you just... perhaps one person is sending 10 or 100 messages real quickly.
Without a doubt, that happens, and that's one reason why, as a first step, we request that individuals include a postal address. An internet address doesn't always reveal the geographic clues you need to know exactly who the sender is, and any elected official is going to want to know whether they're hearing from a constituent of theirs or not. It is very typical with postal mail that interest groups or lobbyists try to get a message across by sheer inundation, by postcard campaigns and mass mailings that will get a message across by bulk. And certainly with email, you make that easy for any interested individual to tell their computer, please send this message to Senator Kennedy over and over and over again.
And electronically, case, right.
And rather than just boxes of mail piling up in the mailroom, now you're talking about bits and bytes and megabytes on our computers. This is an instance where an unexpected benefit of the autoresponder approach has been helpful because we give back as good as we get. And for those who feel it's somehow better to send a message over and over, well,
let's
then
bring another listener in from Santa Ana. Let's hear from Dan.
Yes, hello. And
hi, Dan.
Thank you very much for your knowledgeable guest. And I guess first off, I'd like to find out some information on that action alert. The second thing is I am a commodity trader, and I am looking to attempt to retrieve information about the exchanges over the Internet. I want to know if that is possible and possibly through, I don't know if there's knowledge on Globex, possibly retrieving information on the Internet pertaining to Globex. Second thing would be, is it at all possible, or are there any programs right now that are at the level to work with Internet to achieve a bachelor's degree? And the last thing would be, I heard you mention something about the Federal Register and having access to that information. Is it possible to get that information through the Internet without a cost?
Well, we
I
might
can
be able to help.
That last okay. question.
Go, Chris Casey.
Certainly, I know there's a lot of concern and discussion about the fact that although the Congressional Record and Federal Register are available on the Internet now, it's quite pricey and too expensive for the casual individual browser, and hopefully perhaps that might change in the future. But access to that information is made available to over 1,400 federal depository libraries, and we've mentioned earlier in the program how libraries are an obvious starting point where the public can not only gain the Internet access, but then hopefully find a librarian with knowledge of finding the information and can help point them in the right direction.
At this time, though, libraries are being threatened with being shut down.
In some cases, but there are other examples. Recently, the state of Maryland announced a program called Sailor, through which they plan to make Internet access available to the public at all Maryland public libraries.
Let's welcome Dave to the program from San Francisco. Hello, Dave.
Hello. I wanted to ask your guest if there's any effort being made to bring all of the information from various government information sources together under one, like, for instance, a government information store, something that would do away with the plethora of confusing ways of getting to information online.
It's a question I've had myself. Thanks, David. You know, there's a new disease that accompanies this technology, information overload. How do we get through all this stuff? Jim Warren?
There's too much information to... I would not want to have a single omnipotent agency be the source of all information. That's too much power in the hands of one agency. It's appropriate to have the information come from a variety of sources. And just like when you want to get old-fashioned paper information, you have to figure out which source to get it from. Librarians can assist. Information workers can assist. A lot of the net nerds who surf the net regularly are outstanding sources of either the information directly or a pointer to where the information is. And it's very common across the nets to post a question saying, where can I find this item of information? And get an answer back before you can drop offline.
Chris Casey.
I'd like to add to Jim's point, because I agree with him that multiple sources are a benefit, but there are efforts. NTIS runs a bulletin board.
NTIS?
National Technical Information Service in the Department of Commerce.
And they charge for it.
No, they don't. FedWorld is available. Well, it's dial-up in D.C. I believe it's available via Telnet as well. And no, there's no charge for an account. And it provides gateway access to other federal government bulletin boards. So by connecting to this first source without a separate call or without having to know separate bulletin board numbers or Internet locations, you can then gateway out and find yourself at, I think, over 200 other federal government-run systems.
Thank you, Chris Casey. We are out of time. I want to apologize to our earlier caller, Dan, for not getting to all of your questions. So do call us back. We'll see if we can help you out. That is all the time we have for this interesting subject this hour. My guests have been Sonia Jarvis, Jim Warren, and Chris Casey. Our thanks to all our listeners, to those who called into the program, and thanks to Monitor Radio for their help. Join us again next time. I'm Jude Tillman for the Communications Revolution.
The Communications Revolution is directed by John Rieger. The technical consultant is Tim Pozar. Our on-air engineer is Jim Bennett. Indigo Sum is the administrative assistant. Music created by Tony Kniff. You can receive a free resource list for today's program by sending a stamped self-addressed envelope to Pacifica Radio Archive, Post Office Box 8092, Universal City, California 91608. Ask for program 994. This is the Communications Revolution.
Next on the Communications Revolution, new technologies allow you to scramble all your phone calls and fax messages, keeping them private and secure from all but one possible snoop, the government. Your right to privacy versus the public need to know. That's next time on the Communications Revolution.